Teilhard de Chardin. Prayer to the ever greater Christ. Because, Lord, by every innate impulse and through all the hazards of my life, I have been driven ceaselessly to search for you and to set you in the heart of the universe of matter, I shall have the joy, when death comes, of closing my eyes amidst the splendor of a universal transparency, aglow with fire. From the Christic, one of the last things.
Would you mind reading that one more time?
I will, and then I'm going to jump and read the last paragraph, skipping a bit in the middle. Because, Lord, by every innate impulse and through all the hazards of my life, I have been driven ceaselessly to search for you and to set you in the heart of the universe of matter. I shall have the joy when death comes of closing my eyes amidst the splendor of a universal transparency aglow with fire. Lord of consistence and union, you whose distinguishing mark and essence is the power indefinitely to grow greater, without distortion or loss of continuity, to the measure of the mysterious matter whose heart you fill and all whose movements you ultimately control. Lord of my childhood and Lord of my last days, God, complete in relation to yourself, and yet for us continually being born. God, who because you offer yourself to our worship as evolver and evolving, are henceforth the only being that can satisfy us. Sweep away at last the clouds that still hide you, the clouds of hostile prejudice, and those too of false creeds. Let your universal presence spring forth in a blaze that is once diaphany and fire, O ever greater Christ. And those words, written very shortly before Teilhard's death, really sort of frame the agenda of what I want to talk about this morning. We've been talking gradually over the week about some of the works and essentially obligations and duties laid upon us as human beings, three-brained creatures, as Gurdjieff liked to call them, situated where we are on the ray of creation at that critical mi-fa shock point, where both blessing and subtle substances coming down must be transmitted on through the mi-re do to the developing and evolving parts of the cosmos, and where things gathered and possible here are crystallized and handed back up. So we've talked about that role. We've talked about it in terms of, and spent a lot of time yesterday with the receiving, the conscious reception of the help that comes to us, the guidance that comes to us from the more subtle realms in which we're in relationship, specifically around breathing and specifically around the receiving of these finer substances or vibrations available to us in air, freely given. Air is not the creator of it, of course. Air is the medium through which it is distributed to us through a deeper providence. But we've also talked about the skill and the obligation where it becomes necessary of noticing a part that's missing in the mix and generating it. And we looked about that specifically with regard to Babette's feast and how what she saw in her wise and quiet heart was that these peasants in this community were not faithless. They hadn't lost the embers of that thing which had called them together in the first place. But something was missing. They were so, in some sense, malnourished that they couldn't activate it. They couldn't access it. And she intuited that it was abundance. That they had lived for too long in a climate that was just too mean-spirited, too broken. And they were finally succumbing to its influence and becoming mean-spirited and broken themselves. And so she set about, out of the resources in herself, both available to her in World 48 and in the higher realms, to create by the medium of a banquet, an over-the-top, ridiculous, absurd banquet in terms of worldly logic, that missing ingredient from World 24, and I actually think from World 12, which would transmit what the other traditions call baraka, blessing, a swat of energy that temporarily raises your state enough that you can do what you couldn't do in your lower scale fumbling state. So I want to talk about that as a model for today, because I think it's really, really clear that there's an element conspicuously missing in the atmosphere of our world today. And by world, what I really mean, of course, is World 24 inside World 48. That the whole planet is starving, but particularly keenly at the hands of humankind for the lack of this crucial element. And if it were supplied, and if it would suddenly be there in profusion in the mix, in the newosphere again, as Teilhard calls it, that's the realm of culture, the realm of longing, the realm of that surrounds our planetary coming and going. If it would be present there, an entirely different outcome would be possible in this crucial junction point we stand at right now. And I identify that element consistently over 6 months or so of reflecting on it as courage, the missing element in the mix. I'm not saying that there aren't other missing elements that are in some sense subsidiary to it, but I think courage is the mainstream, and it's the one I want to talk about this morning. I'm not talking in courage about a kind of reckless courage like the teenage macho man who willingly hangs upside down off a cliff on the sure and certain conviction that he's invincible. I'm not talking about that kind of reckless, fallow and callow courage that has not been tested yet in any fire of vulnerability. And I'm not talking about the magical courage that you find in a lot of the church groups, on the more evangelical extreme, that can say, "We are Christian, and therefore Christ is going to keep us from harm." There's a Baptist minister down in Sanford, Maine, who's causing considerable anguish up and down the state. Because he officiated at a wedding in upstate Maine with 100 and some people in mid-July or early August, and it spread COVID. I forget how many sick and 2 deaths, and the whole town of Sanford is terrified, and he holds the services and he continues to spout forth that God protects the people that call themselves Christians. And you know, people were just, you know, it was in the news again this morning. I'm not talking about that kind of courage. The kind of courage that because you think you got God on your side, you recklessly ignore the very prudent public health conventions that have been developing in the crowd. The map that Eva laid out to us so meticulously a couple of days ago. And I'm not even talking about stoic courage of the kind we used to read about in some of the great Greeks. It comes a little bit closer to the mark because it is really grounded in the willingness to die and in the recognition that there are values so intrinsic to the nature of a human being as opposed to an animal, that you have no choice if your number comes up in a situation to choose death over disgrace. So that kind of courage is at least going in the right direction because it forms itself in relationship to death. And it begins to say that there are things, virtues as they actually are called in Greek, that are of such importance to who you are as a human being that to betray them would be to disfigure the face of what it means to be a human being. And that sentiment rose up really heavy duty in our culture with the Greeks. I mean, it's as far as we know, it's always been around with the Chinese and Japanese, who would willingly fall on the sword rather than disgrace, betray family, country, you know, the ideal. So that courage has been around, and we recognize it intrinsically as noble, but that courage is still, for me, individual. That kind of courage comes from World 48. And it's World 48 at its finest. It's the world of ideas, of ethics, of value. It's the world of the Constitution, the world of the Enlightenment, where from the best of what we have in the rational mind, we try to project what it means to be a human being and what is required to be a human being. But I'm talking about something still different, which I'm going to call paschal courage. You know, and this is not after Blaise Pascal, but it's after the paschal mystery, the Easter mystery. And, you know, the word Passover or paschal comes from Passover, Pasch, as it was first called in Latin, is the translation of the Hebrew concept of Passover, that everybody was dying and some were spared, you crossed over, you began, and it's implicitly entwined with the turn that emerges out of death. And so when we talk about the paschal mystery in Christianity, we're talking essentially about the whole life of Jesus, but intensely about what happened in Holy Week. With the realization that the death was necessary, unavoidable, sacramental, and that the heart to do the thing it must do must walk right through it. And the word courage, as we receive it in the English language, it comes from the French cœur, age, the way of the heart. And it's that courage that I want to speak about today, which I think is implicitly, its origin is in World 12. It's implicitly collective in its nature, as opposed to the individual courage of the Stoic. Collective, which means that it transmits the energy of healing. And finally, it begins on the other side of death. Rather than in invincibility, it begins in the kind of vincibility that Bob displayed for us so beautifully in his teaching a couple of days ago, that you discover that in your weakness you are strong. And you discover that the strength doesn't take away your weakness. It simply works with it in a way that forgives it and makes it radiant in its capacity. So I believe it's this kind of courage that has gone dark in our culture, not only outside the church, but even more horrifyingly inside the church. And that it's this missing element that is really necessary to carry us through the crisis that we're now facing, whether it's just a little bitty speed bump in the history of the cosmos or something much larger and more devastating. We don't have the perspective to tell that. Everything looks like the sky is falling down when all you can be is Chicken Little. And all we can ever be in the planet is Chicken Little. So we will be exaggerating the gravity of our predicament right now. But it looks pretty grave, and we might not treat it that way. Better to treat it as grave than to treat it as, you know, a trifle. So I think that whatever else you say about the pandemic, and this is another Red Sea that I want to cross through really carefully without, you know, getting swept away, that it has two dimensions. It has a world 48 and lower dimension, and a world 24 and higher dimension. An inside to the sickness and an outside to the sickness. And the outside to the sickness is that definitely, undeniably, it's killed a lot of people. It's a real, evident, biological scourge, which has put, you know, which has decimated a significant population. It has thinned the human herd by already a significant amount. And I think you have to start with that. It does have a history in World 48, and in that world, it is something to be reckoned with. But it also has an inner component, a psychological component, and that's how it falls upon us, that we're also dealing with a pandemic of terror. And it's that terror that is really driving behavior, and that is creating, you know, we were sitting at the dinner table at our little pod of the dinner table last night, and Timmy was giving us a dialogue on news as a business, and that, you know, that what sells news is fear. Mm-hmm. You know, we all know that. And as a business, it's way more profitable to publish death reports than to publish recovery reports. And so that I think it's clear that on the inner level, we've created out of this, the pandemic is a World 24 pandemic. It's a pandemic of our consciousness, of our collective psyche, following in some sense the laws of energy flows where attention goes, a basic premise of all energy work. And we've become obsessed with this disease, you know, and to the point that we've pulled it out of the pack, separated it out from all the varieties of other flus and other things that have caused human harm, and started with the assumption that death is simply intolerable, you know. That death is a disruption of the natural order of things. The natural order of things is life. a bad assumption to begin with. But that's what we've done. So we've got this paddock in our mind, and you know, with the paddock, people just slither like a herd of lemmings to whatever the new drumbeat is. You know? In our own state, for example, 3 times as many deaths have been registered from opioid deaths as from the pandemic. We're well over 300 in Maine. We haven't yet climbed beyond, I think, 170 COVID deaths here. And yet the opioid pandemic has never received attention, because it never became a pandemic, even while it was sweeping New England and much of the rest of the country, because we didn't put our minds to it. And I think that part of why we didn't put our minds to it was because of this old kind of puritanical thing, well, that was a choice. It's a choice to do drugs. And it's a choice made by less responsible people. And so there was this really, really strong sense that people who get these other illnesses that are way, way, way more fatal, in terms of the statistics that have wiped out the Americans, somehow have made bad choices. You know, I think right up there among the number one killers in Maine is diabetes. And probably much of it has to do with genetics. And much more of it has to do with poor diet. But we don't pay attention to this, because we say, well, you know, they could have chosen to eat differently. And I think that what gives this particular pandemic its particular flavor for nice, respectable people who always make good choices, right, is the sense that we're helpless against it. You know, it doesn't respect the fact that I've had a good diet and been a responsible self-steward for years. I can still die, you know. And so it just blows to smithereens this illusory sense of control that probably is the great watershed between the entitled and unentitled in our culture and in all cultures. You know, and it's this terror that there's nothing we can do to control it. So we do the only things we can do to control it, which is to separate ourselves out and wear masks, and if they tell us we need more filters and masks, you know, anything you can do, go on Zoom, and, you know, kill the churches, you know, just so we don't lose this semblance of control in the fact of something whose roots are way, way deeper than ours. You know, and while I'm not going to lay this out here, because this is not the burden of where I want to go with this, you know, the report that emerged today on the news media about in the past 50 years we've lost 68% of biodiversity of species across the planet in general, and something like 98% in the South America and the Amazon region. And absolutely no doubt, the report says in hard science unequivocally that the chief agent in this is our human excesses, which have changed the basic geophysical, electromagnetic, and geochemical composition of the planet. We've so destabilized our environment in the search for cars, airplanes, you know, lifestyle, that according to Gurdjieffian megalocosmos things, that when you get this kind of an imbalance, and according to Teilhard, when you get this kind of an imbalance, which is threatening the basic biodiversity of the species, you have no choice but to prune the unruly species. And the universe is not going to let us get away with our behavior. And it tends to work numerically, that a certain amount gets thinned out and the balances come back into portion mathematically, and these will disappear again. But so I think that that we have to start with a sensation, you know, that we have no control. That it is a matter of reasonable proportion combined with, as I would say, the generation of something else that fell out and is part and parcel with whatever has prompted the human being to mutate, one would even dare say, to metastasize so egregiously in the planetary body of our Earth. So, as I look back on it, you know, the real essence, what really drives the pandemic of fear, is our absolute refusal to die. Our absolute terror of personal death. That as long as that becomes the thing that just shuts down everything, it's intensely manipulable. Fear is always intensely manipulable. It's only courage that's not manipulable. It's completely predictable. You know, once you know that somebody's going to do this, you know, that the bottom line is save your own skin. You can push it this way, this way, this way, this way. You know? So how do we get there? How do we get to the point where the highest value, I would say, in our culture, I would dare say that if you Googled the word to find out what was the most common word in our vocabulary at this point, and the word that sells more products than anything else, I would venture it's safety. You'll see everything saying, a safe environment, a safe, you know, that somehow what has become our God is this illusion of safety. Safety meaning we're not in a situation where we're going to be at personal risk meaning that we might die. How do we get there? I think we're arguably the first culture in the history of the planet that has ever valued personal safety, lack of risk, above all other possible ingredients. And I think I can trace a couple of steps that I've seen in my lifetime in exactly this 50 years that we've been losing species. One of the things that's happened right along with that has been the massive disinvestment in organized religion in general, in Christianity in particular. Bree has been following this for years, the Pew reports, the way, 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 way more people don't go to church nowadays than do. There's no denominations except for the evangelical extremes that are growing. And I think there's interesting reasons why they're growing, but so we've seen a massive loss, and along with that, a massive loss of basic schooling in the rudimentary precepts of human morality, of human altruism, of even sort of, you know, generic World 48 behavior. Because the churches, for better and worse, passed on a gateway threshold of morality that a culture could be bound to. And that's been completely disrupted in the last 50 years. You probably remember that in your own lifespan. It's been a big, big change. You can ask about that. And I think along with that comes the constant thing which has been broadcast to us in our philosophies for, you know, at least since Jean-Paul Sartre and Rilke and some of those guys, theoretically reinforced, Nietzsche, I meant, not Rilke, sorry. Sam Shriver, forgive me. That we are a random stray bit of a cosmos that doesn't have any meaning. You know, that we're one of billions of galaxies and we just got here by accident. We're not, you know, rather than the human being being the center of the universe as all the old biblical maps did. We're just, you know, random. This just happened. We could be some miscellaneous virus that could be. So we've lost all sense of human dignity, of human purpose, of human sacredness. And, you know, we love to beat up on how stupid could the Catholic Church be to think that the sun revolved around the earth. But there was a moral reason for being so slow to give up on the geocentric universe. And that was because, for moral reasons, it kept people's nose right on the grindstone of what we do here counts. And every time you move the bar so that human beings feel that they're more sort of irrelevant and anomalous in the planet, the more you get behavior which has no place to come home to except my own egoic self. So there was reason in it. Heaven and hell are sort of ludicrous reductionisms of the once noble map of the megalopolis. But at least it kept people on a track. You know, I'm going to be good, so I go to heaven. So at least you try to be good. You know, the people hated trumping off to confession, but it at least forced you to do a moral inventory of your life and to fundamentally discriminate against behaviors which were self-referential and self-perpetuating and value something that was altruistic. So the intellectual climate of our time, the drying up of the Aral Sea of our churches, and in the wake, a rampant consumerism and a psychological structure which has persistently misidentified the true self with the healthy ego. So that the whole thrust of life becomes maintaining your egoic self, maintaining your boundaries, dealing with the stuff that got in you because you were victimized when you were growing up, you know, becoming healthy, becoming sound, and showing it forth by your intense productivity in this world. Impossible. Not the ground that anything can be drawn forth to from that looks like human. That what we've become is apex predators masquerading in human flesh, caricatured, dressed up ironically, like as in a masked ball. Mm. How ironic does it get? So I think that's the state of the things, and so in that way, there's that quotation from the Logia from the Gospel of Thomas, blessed is the lion that the man devours, for that lion will become man. But cursed is the man that the lion devours, for that lion shall become man. And there's an incredible irony and a very, very barbed wit in that. Because it really talks about the upward evolution, the exchange of being, and if this saying does originate with Jesus, it shows that he understood implicitly the great exchange that we're talking about. That when lion becomes man, it means that the bestial nature inside us is integrated, is reborn, domesticated, tame, apprivoisé, the great French word that Saint-Exupéry used, under the aegis of higher consciousness and higher conscience. So it doesn't mean your fire has gone out. It doesn't mean you've repressed your animal self. It means you've integrated it into some, you've put it in order under a higher organizing principle, so it can express itself without, you know, burning down the house. But when man becomes lion, it means that the bestial instinct has taken over, and that the human being has devolved. And instead of understanding herself or himself as being collectively, cosmically obligated toward the transmission and transformation in the Great Exchange, it's like, hell no. You can't even think about these maps anymore, because in the culture of the past 50 years, we've lost the connections that even pick up any of this map, I'm telling you. I can't speak on worlds, I can't speak on talk shows, I can't speak anywhere, because nobody would understand the map I'm using. Mm-hmm. And it's gone. So in that kind of a culture, when man becomes lion, then it says, or blessed is the man, or cursed is the man the lion devours, for that lion, you know, that man shall become lion. No, that lion shall become man. In other words, the animal takes possession of the human form and makes mockery of it. And there we have the planet today. Lions masquerading as captains of energy, of heads of church, of political offices, all motivated by out for number one, all scared shitless to die. If there's one thing that holds us in collusion, it's our most common link as a human family, it's that. Unable to access the higher realms that are there for assistance and for the real revelation of meaning. It's a terrible situation. It's a plight, and we're in it, and we should have been paying more attention to this slow and mysterious decline of the churches, which has been going on for long enough that we should have been paying more attention to why, and not just stopping with formatory logic that they were giving us old truth and old maps and things like that. If anything, they were giving us lack of being, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. because they gave us lack of faith, yeah. and lack of connection to the World 12 gift that sits in the middle of them, at the heart of Christianity. And where I'm going to go for the rest of this presentation this morning is very much toward a reclamation of Christianity's broken link with World 12, its broken link with the Christic realm, and the sense that if we want to find courage, that's where we're going to have to start to work. Because this paschal courage we're talking about has got a different fragrance from most anything that the world recognizes nowadays. And it has a different fragrance from most of what the church recognizes nowadays, which is the most disgraceful and scandalous thing of all. And we have to begin linking back all the way to the dough that started this octave and building out from there again, I believe. So, Christianity 101, why did there have to be a death? A lot of people say, oh, you know, I don't like to Christianity because it's so morbid. You go in a church and there's this big instrument of torture and this bloody person hanging in anguish on it. This doesn't remind me of anything that I like to think religion is. So let's get rid of the crosses and let's just say, you know. But we, you know, The Paschal mystery has always been difficult for Christians and for the rest of the world. It would be really cool if we could eliminate it. But you can't, because it sits right there. We got Methodists doing that. Oh, Sue's probably doing her thing this morning. Yeah, of course, this is Sue's day to be in the church to have her pastoral day. So why? What do we do? Why did there have to be a death? It could so easily have been avoided if he only hadn't gone to Jerusalem. If he had only wised up in time and realized that what he was really being offered was the kingship of Israel, you know, all this mess could have been avoided. He could have probably won. He had a good entree with Pilate's wife. He could have gotten a little grant and founded the Jesus Christ Institute for Spiritual Improvement, and we might still be studying there. But no, there was the certainty. In terms of the Gergifian map, it's clear why he had to die. Because his real mission on the planet was to break open and activate in this powerful way the Paschal connection. The connection between World 12 and World 48. And that the energy that was the evolutionary energy that had to flow into the planet and was a real evolutionary gift at about that time in history was the rising of bodhisattva consciousness. The rising of a sense of new collectivity that we're in this together. That salvation is never private. And the ability to draw a particularly fine quality of love, which is interwoven around personal death like DNA and RNA. It's a double point that gives you the unique fragrance of Paschal love. And he had to activate that in our culture, in our screen. And that's what he did. He opened and activated a connection to that realm so that a kind of quality of love that had not been in evidence in the planet before could manifest and could flow powerfully through it. As a kind of little footnote, I'll say that that I think that if you look in chapter 7 in my book, I have a little bit of a funny thing that I don't want to make too much of a business on, but it really is an attempt to overlay Teilhard's map and his sense of an omega point with a classic ray of creation which goes out and comes back and goes back. What I try to do in there is to rescore it in chiastic form. And most of you in the world room will know what this means. Some of you won't, because we spent a lot of time at the Wisdom School in Valley Crucis working on imaginal causality and saying that imaginal causality is chiastic. That means it's like a pebble thrown into a pond. It makes rings around it. And the causality, rather than being linear and straightforward, takes its initial energy from the thing right in the center, and then it manifests itself in waves. So I believe very strongly, and one of the reasons that I called the World 12 the Christic Realm, is because this little bandwidth that intensely goes on between World 12, 24, and 48 is the chiasm which contains the omega point. Teilhard's right that way. That for all the worlds, that somehow what is going on here, and the heart, I can only say this in personal language because there's no other language that says it, the heart of what God wants to transmit to us, the vulnerable heart of God's own being is somehow conveyed and in the realm of the personal. As love is transfigured from eros, sheer, ultimately free creativity, into bound, humbled agape. And that in this, that the Paschal Mystery is really and truly in a deep way the heart of God.
Mm-hmm.
And when you touch it fully and when you just understand what is involved in being able to live beyond the boundaries of personal and egoic fear of lack of survival, you touch something of such an extraordinary quality that you realize truly God was in this place. And I think that the planet, rather than going down and out in the classic maps, all the way down the scale and back up again, are essentially chiastic around World 12. That's my own take on this. You won't find it anywhere else. But it's why Paschal love has such a pungent fragrance, and why its disappearance from the churches today is such a betrayal and a massive failure of nerve, and I'll say it right out, a collective sin. So Jesus paved the way to allow us to walk, whether I live or die, I am the Lord's. To walk into a way that at first you don't see it, but then you do see the connection, that everything is held. And I'm going to come back to that in a minute. But what does that journey look like if we were going to move from our centrifugal fear, our centrifugal self-preservation, into some other quality? What could it look like? And another of the blessings that accrued from dinner last night and from being stuck in the midst of a table with Timmy and Jimmy on one end, you know, and Bill Espinosa on the other, and all of us talking across the way, is Timmy reminded me of the beautiful story, the recent story, made into a movie of the Atlas Martyrs that was made, that became the basis of the movie Of Gods and Men. Did any of you see it, perchance? if we've got a TV with a DVD feature, we could actually show it tonight. But this is a story that actually happened. How many of you know the story? A few of you. The story needs to be told because it's a walking reclamation in our own time and place of the journey back into courage and what it looks like. It happened in 1996, and it happened in a Trappist monastery in Algeria, in the Atlas Mountains of Algeria. And I was actually still in residence at the monastery in St. Benedict's Nomas, which is a fellow house, a fellow member of the Trappist Order, when all of this was going on. And I was sort of obliquely aware of it, but it wasn't until I saw that they'd named one of their hermitages Atlas Martyrs that I really put the pieces together. So what happened, and this is a completely true story, was that back around, say 1993, a particular kind of terrorism, Islamic terrorism, began to arise, sort of heavy duty. It erupted in that corner of Algeria. And there began to become random slayings, malicious deaths, you know. The movie opens with this little monastery, this Trappist monastery, which has lived in gentle harmony with the people of this Islamic village. You know, providing medical services, they work in the gardens, they grow the produce, the monks take the honey they make and sell it. They're totally assimilated into their Islamic neighborhood without any conversion but with deep respect for the diversities. And all of a sudden, some workers just down the road have been, Croatian workers, have had their throats slit by this terrorist band. So essentially, the terror grows and grows and grows, you know, and that it's only a matter of time. This little Catholic monastery is sitting ducks. It's absolutely inevitable that sooner or later, the terrorists, who are already having traffic with the monastery because the abbot has been giving them medical supplies to deal with their wounded, out of this real sense that, you know, they're human beings too. You know, and he's not going to say, oh, you're terrorists. So they know the monastery. They have some intercourse. And the poor town officials are saying, oh, this is bad. This is really, really bad. You guys are going to, you're going to get killed next. And they know it's only a matter of time. Mm-hmm. And so the movie and the really, really focuses in then on the process that each man in this monastery has to go through to deal with this. And the forum is the chapter meeting where the monks gather and talk about their selves. And you watch them. And they're monks that are terrified. They're monks that want to leave. They're monks that try to leave. And in the end, by some mysterious process, they decide to stay. And there's some beautiful, beautiful, you know, flash-ins in the movie that show you where these turning points come. But they decide to stay. They're not going. There's one beautiful movie, which is one of these turning points, where one of the Islamic women in the neighborhood saying that you're our nest, and we'd be just like birds without a nest if you go away. And they decide that collectively that they find the courage which is in their faith, which is a gospel courage. There's no illusion that God is going to prevent them from the inevitable. Mm-hmm. So at the wrenching epicenter of this movie, you have what you might call the mirror image of Babette's feast. There is a banquet, and somehow or another, one of the monks, who is kind of the Babette of this monastery, brings in a couple of bottles of wine, and they put on the music of Swan Lake, the no Gregorian chant, but this beautiful wrenching thing. And they sip very carefully their little whatever wine is available in two little bottles, and it's extraordinarily Eucharistic. And you see that at that moment of knowing that they will die, they savor together everything that collectively belongs to their humanity. And then, not that night, that would be too Hollywoody, too schmaltzy, but at some point, undistinguished, the terrorists do swoop in a van, pick up all the monks they can find, round up quickly in the middle of the night. Two of them escape, notice, and are spared. The rest are taken off to some place where for, you know, a month or so, hostage negotiations go on. But the mood of the governments at this time is not to appease terrorists. So after a lot of interventions, some of whom were conducted by the Trappist Superior General, who was a good close personal friend of mine, they're beheaded. And the last picture in the movie is of their walking to, in this muffled, foggy, cloudy parade, you know, toward what is sure to be the place of their death. And so it ends. But along the way, the abbot had written this beautiful, beautiful letter, knowing full sure what was going to happen, in which he talks about the what he stands for, which is the healing of the relationships, the total forgiveness and reconciliation between Islamic and non-Islamic people. And there's this beautiful line. How does it go, Tim? Can you say it exactly?
At the end, just trying to find it, the prayer. We're talking about in the last lesson.
Yeah.
I know he opens the last line by saying, and to you, the friend of my final hour.
In other words, the one who will slay him.
Yeah. I don't remember the last bit, but it is something to the effect, to you, the friend of my final hour, I wish you peace. And that the God we both worship will welcome us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Together.
It's this beautiful act of reconciliation that they will recognize each other in love in paradise. World 24. World 48. You know? That which is broken in this world will somehow be healed through the abiding by the laws of World 12. Right on through World 48. And that's what this beautiful movie is about. And for me, that is the most extraordinary depiction of the courage that's possible, the true paschal courage. So I want to just allow, there are many, many other stories we can go to, but the starting gate, I think, for personal work is to reclaim, really go back and visit that Pauline statement, whether I live or die, I am the Lord's. And in point of fact, I've said it wrong because Paul very interestingly puts it in the plural. When we live to the Lord. And when we die to the Lord's. So then, whether we live or die, we are the Lord's. And in so doing, he implicitly invests it with a capability that lies within a group, that may be beyond the individual realization and sustainability of its individual member, very interestingly. But even back in the early part of the pandemic, when I was writing my first blurbs, one of the first things I invited people to do was to go back and really work with this. Work it into your system. And it goes in doses. That your head will get it but won't comprehend it. Your head can never comprehend it. It's not the fault of your head. It's the fault of the wiring system that runs your head. Your heart will get it and back off. Get it and back off. The hard place to work it in is in your body, where the fear, you know, our whole body is sort of put together to preserve the physical container. And to work it in so that you become truly and in three centers able to know that whether you live or die, you are the Lord's, is the gateway to a invincible freedom. You don't see that in World 48. In World 24, you begin to see it. You begin to see, because you've already stepped into the body that knows that death is going through the eye of the needle. You've already begun to taste the you that lives in second body and lives in the imaginal. To the extent that you are blessed enough to develop third body, you not only know it, but radiate it. And that was what was happening, I think, with that abbot by the end of by the end of the movie, that his stay at this in World 12, the knowing that your heart and Christ's heart are so one, that you can't possibly fall out of that love. If ever you know that, then you walk as those that have always kept the life of our faith alive. We call them the martyrs, and that's a sort of World 48 way of looking at it. They're really the people that enact for us over and over the sacramental reality that if we so wish, we are inseparable from Christ for ages, since the beginning of time and beyond the ending of time. They're the people who know that with such a deep stability that they can act it out. And then Christianity is reborn again. As the Gospel of Thomas begins in the very first Logion, those who taste the meaning of these sayings, or those who discover the meaning of these sayings, who grasp it, will not taste death. Doesn't say they won't die, but it does say that they will not be beset by this terror, fear, incapacitating catatonia that happens when the center of our identity is held in our egoic self, which, yes, is mortal. And yes, will die. The only question is when. The only question is shifting your identity to that deeper ground. So I want to suggest just a few very specific practices here that what can we do as Wisdom School gathered here, as we go back, as we prepare tomorrow to depart for our places while still maintaining that greater web, first of all, I think we need to, in a much more intentional way than most of us have done, ingest Christ. Take this person in. And one of the sort of hallmarks of liberal Christianity is that Christ, and even more Jesus, has become a kind of embarrassing word. We try to sidestep around it. We try to prove that you can be a Christian without being a Jesus head. But you can't. This is really the you can be a Unitarian, but this is the center of it. And we need to reestablish personal confidence with this person, personal connection with this person, who is the World 12 light holder of our path. We just have to do it. And there's two ways of doing this. The first way of ingesting Christ is to read the Gospels and to return in a deep way to the call of putting on the mind of Christ. You know, what you eat, you will become. And to spend some time, as the great traditions have done it, in daily Lectio Divina, in any way you want to do it. But focusing on the New Testament, and yes, the Gospel of Thomas fits in here. You got permission to use that too. And to really absorb the teaching of this person, to work your way through the Pauline material. You know, it's uneven like most human beings are, but when it's sublime, oh my God, does he hit it. Does he name things that can be named in no other way? But the other thing that I would recommend is to spend time with the mystics, with the ones in our tradition who have most profoundly seen and grasped this. The Teilhard de Chardin is in modern times, that abbot at Atlas Mortar, your own people whose faith has been unbroken, who've seen this mystery, to just hang out with them. Teilhard, to read the divine milieu again from the point of view of imaginal causality is a trip, because you realize that what he's doing, talking about the divine milieu, is he's talking about the connection between world 24 and world 48 held together in world 12. It's all right there. All you have to do is reallocate the vocabulary, and it falls into perfect line. And then there's Ladislaus Boros. That some of you know that I and a bunch of others in Northeast Wisdom were instrumental in getting republished this wonderful book from 1960s, a mystical revelatory book called The Mystery of Death. And toward the end of this, you know, his bottom line is that death is not this big boogeyman that puts an end to everything, but is essentially the threshold gateway into being able to make our first truly personal act of free choice. And we prepare for it all our lives. And in the basis of the preparations and choices we've made, we choose to say yes to the pleroma, or to contract and become a rock in the stream of it. But his mystical vision, which is grounded in his own extraordinary take on Teilhard, is just so profoundly powerful that I can't resist. He reads better than almost anybody I know. He reads in the cosmic that's there in Teilhard, the evolutionary, with the possible. So that he's doing in a way that goes far beyond Teilhard, taking the epicenter of the Paschal mystery and making that the center of evolution going forward. He had a couple of beautiful lines. When in the way we have just explained, Christ's human reality was planted in death, right at the heart of the world. Within the deepest stratum of the universe, the stratum that unites at root bottom all that the world is, at that moment in his bodily humanity, he became the source. He became the real ontological ground of a new universal scheme of salvation, embracing the whole race, human race. Henceforth, all men without exception can enter into bodily contact with Christ, and precisely by means of the cosmic reality with which each man is so intimately connected. The world is the essential dimension of every spiritual activity of man, whose soul is bound up with material being in a single substantial unity. But if Christ in his manhood has been planted in the basis of the world, the substantial unity of the human soul with material being has been changed ontologically. The whole of our personal assimilation of the world has received through this fact a new divine dimension. Perhaps this might help us to better explain why our world is so deeply and mysteriously filled with the reality of Christ, and why man in his spiritual and personal life, when all is said and done, and whether he knows it or not, is always concerned with Christ.
Glory.
What?
Glory.
Isn't that something? Oh God, going on to just a few more. He's talking about the three, the crucifixion, the resurrection, the ascension as the three inflection points in the journey of Christ. And this one is finally beautiful. Finally, as regards the resurrection and what happened in it, before his death, Christ existed in what Johannine theology calls the flesh. the domain of weakness and frailty, the existential relationship of a cramped, sealed-off, visible thing, bound, as it were, to a definite spatio-temporal place. In other words, Christ dragged himself around in a human body. In sealed off visibly, yeah. In the process of his death, Christ finally laid aside the fleshly components of his visibility and entered into the universe in its wholeness with its openness of being. This meant that the whole world was introduced into a clarified system of being, into the dimension of the pneumatic, the ultimate finality of a world permeated and transformed by the Spirit has dawned. World 12, permeating world 48. The end of time, the universal transfiguration has come. Our world and what it has already become is essentially heaven. But the fundamental transfiguration of being is still hidden, awaiting its revelation at the end of time. The great sign that this working of the Spirit into and through all being has indeed already taken place, in spite of all its veiling from us, is given in Christ's risen body. This is a body permeated by Spirit and removed from the domain of cramped, transitory things. Oh my God. You know, it's like, how can a person think this? How can a person feel it? But the imagination exists that allows us to see in the heart of our own heart the complete co-inheritance of World 48, not only in World 24, but in World 12. And if we can live out of that epicenter, Christ becomes not just a statue in the corner of the church, but operative, to use the word that Teilhard used, of course, assuming the reins of evolution. It's extraordinary how we've lost that, the collapse of our spiritual sacred imagination. So the other couple of practical things I've suggested, you know, on the list is, first of all, as you go back, seek out in your own community the places that are actually meeting on the ground, and find one, and if you can find one that is not based on reckless courage, that, you know, I'm a Christian, Jesus won't kill me, you know, but is based on that quiet, invincible sense that in gathering, you've already stepped across a threshold of personal fear into the sustenance of whether we live or die. In other words, this little church right here is one of these places, which is why they could unhesitantly offer to us the gift of their space. The places that can do this quietly, and if you can't find any in your community, create one.
Create one.
But there need to be, you know, on the ground, tiny meeting places where we experience whether we live or die, we are the Lord's. So find them and support them in your community. The theology that most corresponds to your own, but if you can't find that, find something where a group of faithful remnants of Christians are stepping one step further into the reality, to the risk of their faith, the cost of discipleship, as Bonhoeffer called it. Eucharist. You know, Eucharist has taken a hard hit in our time, that because it was so immediately perceived as a source of contamination, And it was already under hard duress anyway, because in our allergophobic cultures, I don't do gluten. I don't do wine. it's like we were already going towards BYOB Eucharists, and the loss of confidence in these primary alchemical symbols, and the sense coming up in World 48 that the scientific causality of World 48 trumps the spiritual efficacy, you know. That if you're an alcoholic and you drink wine from the communion cup, you're going to be a drunk again. You know, if you eat the bread of Christ that's got gluten in it, you're going to be reeling over and retching. You know, this degree of holding the sacrament imprisoned in our World 48 logic is a symptom of the general fearfulness and self-protectiveness. So to bring forward this vessel. And I consecrate you at the moment, all deputy priests.
Yes.
Yes.
Feel the energy. I'm not messing around here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You are all consecrated as deputy priests.
Priesthood of all believers.
Yep. And your assignment is to celebrate the Eucharist. Every day, if you can, whatever is your periodicity, with your own pod, sharing bread and wine. You know, the Catholics have been drifting back, and the Episcopalians even finally drifting back, but they're going right back to the 50s, who are saying, well, we're not going to mess with the cup. We're just going to let the priest drink the cup and the lay people can have their wafers again. I'm not going to put up with COVID as an excuse for regressive theology. We also have a model that comes from the Catholic Church that you can see in all the old churches, where there were individual altars downstairs beneath, where every priest celebrated the Mass daily, usually with one altar boy. And you may think that was voodoo, but it talks about the flexibility of the flexibility of the body of Christ to assume a shape that's efficacious. And in our own time, where it's playing a little bit too much Russian roulette and being reckless, to, you know, you're not going to get people to stand around a church and drink from a common cup just yet. The energy's missing. But in your pods you do it. With your family members. You go into your little altars and you celebrate the Eucharist, because this ritual must not die. Must not vanish. Not only from the face of the earth, but must not vanish during this time of pandemic. And if the only way we can celebrate it is to celebrate it in our families and our pods. Mm. Yeah, Don.
I've been trying to hold this in for the last few days. Can you help me put together, we've got this fear thing that you've been talking about, and then you overlaid this COVID on this fear thing, or overlaid fear on the COVID thing. On the one hand, you've brought up a couple times seeing these people drive by in their cars all alone wearing a mask.
Mm-hmm.
Almost, I mean, you're not mocking them, but you're holding them up as examples of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And come on. On the other hand, we've got this preacher down south of Maine who has no fear. He's not wearing a mask in his car.
Mm-hmm.
He's on the other extreme where he's holding a gathering.
Mm-hmm.
and of 100 plus people at this wedding. And his carelessness results in the multiplication of people who have been infected.
Yeah.
So here's foolishness and here's fear, and you're holding them both up as bad examples.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying, oh man, my... And then somewhere over here is in your pod, drink from a common cup. So I'm totally confused as to what your message is to us about COVID. Can you help me?
Maybe. It would be a good doing if I can. You can't tell the difference between those two extremes with the mind.
Oh.
But they taste different. You know the difference. I don't think that minister down in Sanford is fearless. I think he's brainwashed. And that this reckless courage that derives from belief, from having Nestor's sense of things and by a kind of vicarious power and control, you can spell it. You can spell it. And you could smell the difference between that and a cautious and respectful willingness to take a risk on behalf of the whole. And my sense is, to put it quite frankly, that of course it would be more sensible from the point of view of World 48 if we just put the Eucharist on hold until somebody magically told us it was safe to go back in the water. And then we all go back to church again and do it like nothing ever happened. But I do not believe that it's going to shift around that easily. And I believe that as I was trying to say earlier today, that there's a spiritual sickness which is also being exposed in this disease, a spiritual laziness and a spiritual hypocrisy. And that in the service of addressing those directly, and I find very few people addressing them directly, the right disregards and the left lies, that there's an imaginal element missing from the mix. So what I'm advocating is not social policy. This is very, very small group, invisible, upper room kind of work to feed into the mix in the way that I'm going to talk about more this afternoon. An element which I think like leaven or homeopathy can slightly adjust the mix on the outside. That can slightly reduce the huge layer of fear. And it is a tightrope, Don, because it's a balancing of sensible precaution in yourself, respect for the conditions, respect for the other person, and faithfulness to a Christic vision that in some sense courage, if it's paschal courage, will be efficacious. And I don't mean by that that it'll be protected, that it won't die, but that it's necessary. And you just have to find your way with that.
Okay, let me interrupt. I'm a little bit frustrated here. You were talking about creativity and navigating through this crisis or through this COVID thing. And I was at a black church 2 weeks ago, and they served communion because it's important to them in these prepackaged cups that you flip off and the wafers on the top.
Yeah.
And yet 2 days ago, I don't know whether it was a sidebar conversation or it was part of the plenary session, we were making fun of that as less than.
Yeah, yeah.
And in my opinion, they're trying to do a balancing act here, and that's their solution.
Right.
And
no, I don't.
I was shocked that we were making fun of it. I mean, I'm not judging anybody.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to find out what's my takeaway or what's our takeaway from, in terms of the practical.
Yeah. I don't recall making fun of that, and I personally wouldn't do that because I think that's an incredibly creative and adaptive solution. When we were in Valley Crucis, what we did was we had everybody bring their own bread and wine, mm-hmm. And then we allowed groups that felt absolutely comfortable together to form pods and share a common cup. And they were people that were basically husbands and wives, so that there was no pushback whatsoever about sharing a cup beyond where you could really feel going. But no, I think that the individual packaging is a profoundly creative response to now. And one of my own feelings in this is that Eucharist admits of creativity and flexibility. And it's only when you get it too tied up in doctrinal rubrics that you kill it. I think these people were doing fabulous things to say, yeah, there's going to be bread and wine, it's going to be important to us, and we're going to reduce the fear barrier to a place where the ritual can become meaningful and not scary. Mm-hmm. Brilliant. It's a perfect solution. And we've even encouraged people for the duration that if you develop things that for the while said, COVID is in our midst and we want to be prudent and we don't want to throw people into fear so high they can't act, invite them to bring their own communion vessels and develop a little industry that makes really beautiful ones. You know? Come to church with your own communion kit. You can buy these things. And they're not just a plastic cup and a miscellaneous plastic plate. They're beautiful revelation. And who's seen a communion kit? You take them out to people that are dying. Mm-hmm. They're beautiful. And I think issuing communion kits to people, telling them to be responsible for it, and then depending on the fear level and the actual circumstances in a given population, you can either have people bring their own bread and wine, which is probably the maximum safe in terms of World 48, or if there's a reasonable sense that you're in a fairly safe community, you can pour wine from a common cup into individual glasses. That's another step out. Bread, wafers are probably cleaner and more easily for distribution than the paws pulling across hunks of bread. That has to play by the situation. But my thing is, don't abandon the Eucharist. Adapt the circumstances. The theology is incredibly flexible. Jesus can take a common loaf and a common cup and break it into parts among a million people. Or he can take a million parts and fuse them into one single common cup and common loaf within the mystical body of Christ. So work it either way. The promise is, I will be present. I will feed you. The whole thing was authorized by Jesus from the start to feed us when we weren't strong enough. It's higher being food. So does that help address it, Don? It's the creativity comes in the sensitive balance between the external conditions and the internal possibilities.
So you're saying that with the Eucharist, as well as with our response to COVID, we should smell our way through it?
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah, smell your way through it. And if there was any impression given that I was mocking, I'm trying to think back to what I was thinking of if I said it. And I remember not being too impressed when I was a child with the little trays with the little grape juice and little white cubes of bread that we got in there.
You're not super generous with the Protestants. We know this.
Yeah, I know. I'm not really generous. I gotta watch my tongue in this era. But in this way, we must not lose our connection with Jesus is the final message, because it's from this world, I believe, in World 12, reclaimed. Including the cost of discipleship. Mm. And I would say right off the bat, Some will be sickened and some will die. And I take that on, you know, myself. I realize in myself that I'm actually one of the ones that's best positioned to do this because, you know, I got a pacemaker 5 years ago. I'm living on borrowed time. I'm dying on borrowed time. It's easy for me. And because it's easy, I feel like it's kind of, it's a place I can be in. And I can stand there and others will stand in different places. I'm not trying to say that all Zoom church is bad. I'm not trying to say that all Christians are turncoats and pimple heads. But I am saying there is a need for an infusion of a certain kind of courage that is not in the mix now. And as it's not in the mix, it's causing an erosion of Christianity. And there are some that are going to have to put it back in the mix in this kind of way to join hands with the others that are doing the work, the other kind of work. Because what we're getting continues to not enthuse people, you know. So that the whole thing can work. It really can work. It's the most powerful mystical stream that ever hit the planet. But we got to find our way back to that. And I can't not believe that COVID does not have reverberations in worlds above our own. You know, even in a biological level. There's just the planetary damage that we human beings is inflicting is so terrifying that it's just plain stupidity to think that, oh yeah, and then COVID just coincidentally happened and California is just coincidentally burning up and Portland, Maine has just coincidentally had the record 3 hottest summits in record. It's, you know, we're even in the world 48, we're not paying attention. Then when we kind of add into this that we've got some duties and obligations in other worlds from which the beauty of our human soul shines, then you begin to see that COVID is, if nothing else, the opportunity for a profound wake-up call. And if we're going to be sort of sitting on the shore waiting for the clearings to go back in the water anyway for another 9 months, we might as well use the time to look deeply within and to begin to reclaim these individual acts in groups